You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And whoop, just tried to unlock the lines there. I think Paul did the same thing at the same moment. Mitt Romney has a new app out. No, I'm serious. We've got an app, an iPhone app, and on it you can read our blog every day, and you can participate in our message boards, and there's links to all the stories we talk about, all kinds of cool stuff. But Mitt Romney has a new app, and you know, on our app it says Tom Hartman on the main page, the flash page, the whatever it's called, cover page. And I actually spelled my name right. You know, it's I'm sorry, say that again. No. So anyhow, I spelled my name right, but Mitt Romney, on the homepage of his app, it says a better AmerCia. It's not just that he misspelled America. Now, George Herbert Walker Bush, if press reports are to be believed and books about his history and some of the research that Lamar and I did when we were poking around into the JFK days, George Herbert Walker Bush had worked for the CIA for some years. And, you know, then ended up director of the CIA. So you could imagine, you know, given that he was kind of a career CIA guy, in fact, there's a fairly good story that I think has probably some credibility that George Herbert Walker Bush's oil company was, Zapata Oil, was a front for the CIA because they basically had a drilling rig off the coast of Cuba at the time that Operation Zapata happened, which was the CIA code name for the Bay of Pigs invasion. So, you know, you can kind of put two and two together on that. So if George Herbert Walker Bush had an ad that was AmerCia, is that Brad on line 11 by any chance? No. Okay. That it was AmerCia, that would make sense. But this is altogether strange. So that said, there are some really remarkable things going on in the news. First of all, there seems to be a national effort on the part of the corporate media in the United States to ignore what Rick Scott is doing down in Florida. Rick Scott down in Florida, this is mind-boggling. The governor of Florida ordered his previous attorney general to come up with a list of illegal voters. Now, George W. Bush spent over $70 million looking for illegal voters during the 8 years of his presidency. He ordered all 100 federal prosecutors, ordered them all to drop what they were doing with, you know, real serious crime stuff and start looking for people who were voting but were not U.S. citizens. In other words, not eligible to vote. And after spending $74 million and 5, 6, 7 years at this, they had found a couple of dozen people who were voting while felons in states where that was illegal. You know, there are some states in the United States where after you've paid your time, after you've paid your dues to society for the crime that you've committed, and you're out of prison and your parole is over, you can apply to vote. And there's some states where you can't. Once you're a felon, you can never vote again. Most famous of those states being Texas and Florida. So George W. Bush had hit the Justice Department searching high and low for these illegal voters. Now, there's a reason that they put all this time and money and effort into that, and that reason is paying off right now with Rick Scott down in Florida, the governor in Florida. There's a reason why James O'Keefe went out, you know, the guy who does these gotcha videos, the Shirley Sherrod video, and the guy's basically I'm reluctant to characterize him because it'll get into ad hominems, but let us say I have very little respect for James O'Keefe. And he goes and says he's going to make a video about illegal aliens voting. And he videotapes these two people voting. And says, these guys are illegal aliens. And he puts it out. And, you know, we're going to the private individuals. I think they may have the basis for a lawsuit. I don't know. But it turns out that both of them were aliens at one time, immigrants. And both of them, before they registered to vote, became naturalized U.S. citizens. In fact, the voter registration rate among naturalized U.S. citizens, the people who just got their citizenship papers, is really high. I mean, people, in order to become a U.S. citizen, you got to jump through all these hoops. I mean, Louise and I watched our sister-in-law go through this. It was a 5-6-7 year process. I don't remember how we had to write letters to the INS vouching for her. And yes, she's really married to my brother-in-law. And yes, they really love each other. No, it's not an arranged marriage. No, it's a, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You got to go through all this stuff. I mean, it's a real challenge. And sometimes, I mean, it doesn't even work. One of my nieces, is married to and had kids with somebody who's not a U.S. citizen who was in the United States and couldn't get citizenship. They all had to move out of the country. They had to move to Mexico. So, I mean, that's how tough it is. So people who are here illegally are not going to show up at the local polling place and say, "Hi, here's my name. I want to vote." It just doesn't happen. Never has, never will. Bush spent $70 million looking for it, couldn't find it. All his prosecutors could find was a couple of dozen people in places like Texas, where it's illegal for felons to vote, who were ex-felons who thought that they could vote. And so they went and registered to vote. Which is arguably a crime, and now they're back in the slammer because Bush's prosecutors were all over him for it. Oh, look at this voter fraud. That was the kind of voter fraud they found. And even at that, more people are struck by lightning every year than commit voter fraud. And the vast majority of voter fraud is one of two forms. It's either ex-felons who are voting in states where it's illegal and didn't realize it's illegal in that state because they probably grew up in a state where it wasn't illegal, or just nobody ever told them, or... I mean, because if you had spent 5 years in prison, would you really want to commit a crime that could throw you back in jail for a year or two by registering to vote? No, not a chance, if you knew that it was a crime. Or people like Ann Coulter and Mitt Romney. Ann Coulter registered to vote at her agent's address because she didn't want people to know her home address. And Mitt Romney registered to vote, saying that he was living in the basement of his son's house in Massachusetts because he wanted to be able to vote in Massachusetts. He said in the debates so he could vote against Teddy Kennedy while he was living in the mansion in California where he has hired a lobbyist to build an elevator for his car. Or to lobby the city for the permit to build the elevator for his car. He's been living in California for a long, long time. But he's maintained his Massachusetts voter registration. That's the kind of voter fraud. So Rick Scott is saying, look at that, there's voter fraud. And so we're going to take hundreds of thousands of people and knock them off the voter rolls. And guess what? They tend to have Hispanic surnames, or they tend to have surnames that are typical and common among African Americans. What a surprise. Rick Scott is knocking tens of thousands. Well, so far it's just thousands. But, the goal is tens of thousands of African Americans and Hispanics, largely Democratic voters, off the voting rolls in Florida. Remember, George Bush allegedly won by 500 votes. Actually, Gore won by a little over 1,000, according to the New York Times. But in any case, it's going to be tight in Florida.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Rick Scott is doing everything he can to make sure that it's not tight, that Florida goes for Romney. This is a crime.
Now you've got your wars, but does it kind of make you think? A nation on the brink, does the drum of music W was playing high?
This is about the Florida election? George W. Bush? Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, about 2000, yeah. Thank you, Shane. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I spent the majority of the first segment of this show telling you the history of so-called voter fraud in the United States, how George Bush spent years, you know, virtually all of his presidency having all of his federal prosecutors scour the country for voter fraud, how basically any immigrant would be insane to show up at a polling place and say, "Hi, my name is so-and-so." And in fact, told you the story about the husband of my niece who was not a legal citizen and was not successful in getting citizenship. And they both left the country. They moved to Mexico. Or all the troubles that my sister-in-law went through becoming a U.S. citizen. It's a huge challenge, and you don't take this stuff lightly. So first of all, illegal immigrants are not going to be voting. And secondly, when Bush was looking for all this voter fraud, what he found in large part was two kinds of voting fraud. A, people who were felons who had registered to vote in states where it was illegal. Now, again, this could not be intentional. If you've spent 5 years in the slammer, you are not going to show up at a polling place and say, "Hi, I would like to vote. By the way, I realize that doing so sets me up for another year in jail." Not going to happen. These people probably grew up in states where you could vote after you had served your time. Some states don't let you. Some states you lose your right for the rest of your life, like Texas and Florida. So they found that, you know, just a few dozen of these people. And they found people like Ann Coulter and Mitt Romney. Ann Coulter registered herself at her agent's house. Mitt Romney registered himself in the basement of his son's house in Massachusetts, even though he's living in California in a mansion that is so fancy and so elegant that he hired a lobbyist to lobby the city to get the permit to put an elevator for one of his wife's Cadillacs in his beach house in California. But that's where he lives. But he votes in Massachusetts. That's the kind of voter fraud that they found. They didn't find any real voter fraud. But it was all a setup. It was all stage dressing to make Americans believe, particularly Americans who watch Fox News or get Republican talking points in email, make them believe that there is voter fraud going on so that they could do what's going on in Florida right now. Brad Friedman is with us. He's the founder and editor of BradBlog.com. And Brad, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Yes, people like Ann Coulter. That's the key there, because they actually had Ann Coulter, who they could have prosecuted, who blatantly committed voter fraud, but they chose not to prosecute her, and instead they're going after all kinds of people for whom there is no evidence at all that they have committed voter fraud, and they're essentially forcing them to prove they are innocent, rather than assuming they are guilty.
Which seems to me unconstitutional, if nothing else.
Well, it's unconstitutional, and it's something that even the Republican Secretary of State in the state of Florida refused to do. Basically, the governor of Florida came up with these 180,000 names of voters, registered voters, that they are claiming are non-citizens, but there's really no verification for it.
So yeah, they're really, actually, Brad, if point of fact here that I tell me if I'm wrong on this, the using the criteria that the Secretary of State used to come up with this list, it was the Secretary of State, right?
Well, it was.
I thought it was the AG.
State refused to enforce this list because he was not able to verify it.
Right.
At all.
So it wasn't a list of people who probably were not citizens. It was instead a list of people for whom the Secretary of State could not verify that they were citizens.
Yes. Sort of. That's the problem. We don't even know how they came up with these names. And now as we're finding out, and as these voters are being stunned to learn when they're receiving these letters, telling them that they are not citizens, a huge percentage of these people are in fact perfectly legal citizens. And yet they're telling them that if they don't request a hearing within 30 days, they will be removed from the rolls. And we're talking about people who have voted for decades. We're talking about World War II heroes. Think Progress had a story on a 91-year-old World War II
hero. Well, and in fact, here's a clip from Bill Intercola. And I've noticed that it's all the names that I've seen so far, and tell me if I'm off on this, Brad, they all end with a vowel, which is typical of Hispanic names.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes. Yeah. Here's Bill Intercola. This is a 12-second clip.
I was amazed when I got the letter. I have to tell you that. I've been voting since I was 18 years old, or what it was. I don't know. And I never had any trouble.
Bill Internicola, I'm sorry, and a decorated World War II veteran, but apparently his crime in the state of Florida was being registered to vote with a name that ends with a vowel.
Well, listen, and the huge percentage of these names are Hispanics, Democrats, in contradiction to what the population of Florida actually is. And if you're not, you know, if you're out of town for the summer, you've gone on your family vacation, you've got 30 days to request that you have a, get a hearing, and then you must go about proving you're a citizen. And if you don't do that, you will be off the rolls come this November. This is, you know, a problem, and it's not, by the way, not only going on in Florida. We're seeing something similar going on in Tennessee, where they're essentially making voters disappear from the rolls, and it's not really being covered. But as we saw in 2000, this could be...
There's a media blackout on this. We just have 10 seconds, Brad. None of the national media is covering this?
MSNBC, Rachel Maddow has a little bit. Miami Herald has been covering it, but they're not really covering the big picture.
But the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, none of those, and of course, Fox's Wall Street Journal, Financial Times. I mean, this is a huge story. This is rigging an election. If this were going on in Guatemala,
after the election,
yeah. Yeah, if this was going on in Guatemala or Mexico, we'd be going, ah, see, I told you so. Those third world countries, they don't know how to run a democracy. Amazing. Brad Friedman, bradblog.com. You can read all about it. Brad, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. You can do something about this. You might want to call the governor's office in Florida or call one of the Florida senators or call some congressmen from Florida and say, what the hell is going on in your state?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, seriously, what is going on in Florida? This smells of criminality. Welcome back. In the last half hour, we were asking what's going on in Florida where they're purging people from the election rolls, from the voting rolls. Well, comparably, what's going on in Michigan where if you vote and you vote somebody into office, the governor comes along and says, nah, you can't do that. And then when people say, hey, let's get the governor out of here, let's sign this petition, the governor says, oh, you used the wrong typeface, the wrong font. It's not right. We're going to ignore your petitions. Tony Tripiano is with us. He's the host of The Tony Show, the website thetonyshow.org. The actual name of the show on WDTW, which is carrying us right this minute, is First Shift with Tony Tripiano. Tony, welcome back to the program.
It's a pleasure to be with you, the king of progressive thought.
Yeah, right. It is great to always it is always great to have you on, my friend and brother and fellow Michigander, or Michiganian, I guess if you're younger. What's the deal here? Well, this whole font thing originally seemed to me like absurd that the court would knock it down immediately. I mean, typesetters arguing.
Well, let me explain that we are in the process of waiting, if you can believe this, for the appeals court to decide whether 14 point is 14 point or whether it's really just 14 point. And if it sounds like I'm talking in circles, welcome to my world, Tom.
Yeah, and just for people who don't know what we're talking about, types is measured in points, and a 14 point type is, you know, in the neighborhood of a quarter inch high. It's typically in a book. Or in a newspaper, the type is somewhere between 8, 10, or 12, you know, larger type, 12 points. 14 type would be the kind of type that you see as subheads or, you know, the slightly larger type. It's not quite big enough to be a headline. That would be like 16 or 18 or 20 point type. So there we are. Tony.
Well, we have a state board of canvassers. There are two Democrats, two Republicans that sit on this board. There was a question literally 40 minutes before this issue was to be put to bed. We would see on the ballot come November, basically the question is Public Act 4, which is our emergency manager law, which takes away our democratic rights from duly elected members of our communities. at the behest of the governor, who really doesn't need anybody's permission to do this under this new law, again, titled Public Act 4. Enough signatures were submitted. There were enough signatures confirmed that they were legitimate. So that
what were the thresholds and what was the number?
They needed to get 160,000 signatures. They had 220,000.
Mm-hmm.
So they had more than enough signatures. And so it was really just a matter of really just saying, okay, yeah, the signatures are good. Well, and again, 40 minutes before this was to happen, a group comes along and says, we are now going to challenge the size of the 14-point size of the font, which by state election law, it has to be. Here's the problem. One of the people that sits on the State Board of Canvassers happens to share the same address with the quote-unquote group that was challenging the font size.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, that's problematic. So you would think that this person, although he was asked publicly by me and many others to recuse himself, refused to do so.
What's his name?
I don't remember his name, Tom, off the top of my head.
That's fine. No problem.
Anyway, you know, this isn't a difficult, this isn't even a long story. They decide along party lines, 2-2, to the two Democrats voting to approve, the two Republicans voting not to approve. Now it ends up with the appeals court. Well, so now it's at the appeals court. The appeals court, by law, gets to decide the issue. If they say that it's not 14-point font, then it's dead. 220,000 signatures are thrown away, waste of time, democracy is aborted.
Amazing.
If the appeals court decides that they are going to let it stand, then things are okay. Here's part of the challenge. The appeals court panel, there were three that were randomly chose, happened to be the three most conservative members of the Michigan Court of Appeals.
Oh, interesting. Randomly chose?
Quote, unquote, randomly.
Who made the choice?
Well, that's a great question. Now, we're going to assume, because they don't do these things in public, that whoever in the appeals process makes that decision, I don't know if they throw names in a hat. Nobody knows, because they don't make that stuff public.
This is state court?
State court.
Yeah, so the State Court of Appeals. Do you know anything about this group that did the challenge that lives at the same address as one of
They only existed to challenge these petitions. They were born, they did their thing, and they have died. They no longer exist. They were just there to challenge the petition, the font size, which you gotta wonder at what level, who said to them, hey, listen, you got a long shot, but let's throw it out there. It's not 14-point font. Now, by the way, there's testimony. There has been expert testimony. There have been testimony by graphic artists who have said, yes, this is legitimately 14-point font. Tom, you're going to be shocked to hear that not only did the State Board of Canvassers not hear that testimony, neither did the Court of Appeals. Explain how that happens, because I can't figure that one out.
Why did they not hear the testimony of typographic experts who said that it was 14-point? And I'm assuming by the type face you're talking about, the writing at the top of the petition that defines what it is or something like that?
Correct.
Yeah, okay, so it's got to be big enough for the average person to read, even if they have a little hard time reading, is
right.
What 14 and, point
and,
would
and
do.
Certainly, it certainly qualified by every. In fact, I was at a rally at the state capitol just a couple weeks ago. In fact, you had me on your show to talk about that rally. And one of those experts approached me and said, listen, I was one of the people that was there to testify, and they would not listen to my testimony. He actually handed me a document that showed, in fact, he was wearing a tie that actually had a little measuring device on it that showed different size fonts. This,
right.
Trust me, this guy's the real deal.
Yeah, a point rule. I used to own an ad agency. I was never a typesetter, but I had high typesetters working for me. In fact, back in the early days, used to use Linotype machines. I mean, you'd have to go out and get typeset. And, I'm quite familiar with this. And which raises even a larger question, Tony Trupiano, and that is, why would anybody care? If the point of 14-point type, if the reason that that was originally written into law was to make sure that it's bigger than the type in a newspaper, not so big that you can't fit enough information on, but big enough that somebody who usually would have to read, you know, wear reading glasses or something, if they were just, you know, casually approached in a shopping center, wouldn't have to whip out their reading glasses. They could read it, they could figure out what it said, and they could decide whether or not to sign it. In other words, legibility, right? That's the goal.
Right.
Wouldn't it make sense that the two Republicans on the board of what's the board called?
The Board of Canvassers.
That the two Republicans on the Board of Canvassers would say, well, you know, the reason the law says 14-point is because it wants to, you know, if it's legible and it looks either legible or illegible to us, and they would make their argument based on that, because there are 14-point type fonts. That are actually hard to read, you know, the really highly stylized ones, the ones that look like ransom note lettering. I mean, you could do 14 point in a way that's hard to read. But if legibility is the issue, then why don't they litigate it on that?
Well, you know, yes, all 14 point fonts are not created equal. We can all agree on that. Here's the issue. There actually is legal precedence to the question of legibility. So you ask it an incredibly important question, which has been answered by lower courts. Will this appeals court honor those lower court rulings? And that is the question at hand. And Tom, we may get an answer on this any day now. Obviously, the folks that were in the room the day that the State Board of Canvassers denied this, and most of those people, of course, were in downtown Detroit when the appeals court convened and listened to arguments, obviously not fully, because I just told you they wouldn't hear testimony as to experts, typographical experts. But with all that being said, these are people that care deeply about democracy. These are people that are just saying, all we're asking is for the spirit of what we originally were looking to do, which was just place this on the ballot and let democracy do its job. If people want the law, then they vote for it. If they don't want the law, they vote against it.
Right.
That's all we're saying, Tom. That's it.
Well, clearly that's what the Republicans don't want. And if my recollection of measuring type sizes is correct, and I may be wrong on this, but my recollection is that the leading is included in the type size. Now, the leading is the space underneath the type that separates the top line from the bottom line. And it's called leading because it used to be little strips of lead. And so if you've got a point of leading underneath, then if you put a point ruler down, if I'm using the right word, it might look like the type is only 13 points high, but it's got a point of leading underneath it, and that's 14 point type. But again, this shouldn't be the point. Legibility should be the point.
Correct. You are correct on all accounts, and legibility was the point, it was the issue, it was satisfied by the way, the folks that had the petitions printed went to a printer that was practiced at this. They didn't go to some novice printer, Tom Hartman.
Right.
They went to somebody, and by the way, that printer also has to sign an affidavit against the penalty of perjury. That's right, it's perjury if you deliberately print petitions that do not meet state standards. So
amazing.
Everything was set and ready to go.
Real quick question, Tony. Are the appeals court judges appointed or elected?
Appointed.
Appointed. By the governor?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Tony Truppiano, thetonyshow.org. First shift with Tony Truppiano on WDTW. Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm sorry, Tony. I didn't hear part of that. Thank you, Tony, for being with us, if you're still there. Yeah, apparently he's gone. Okay, we'll be back. So to recap, this is incredible. Down in Florida, you've got but actually, I think the most incredible part of this is that this is not on the front page of the New York Times. That the Washington Post is not covering these stories. That NPR isn't talking about this stuff. That USA Today isn't mentioning it. That none of these large entities that are either corporate or sponsored by corporations, that none of them are pointing out that wealthy people and big corporations, and in some cases foreign people and corporations are bankrolling our democracy now. If you want to still call it a democracy, it's starting to look like an oligarchy to me. Are bankrolling our democracy courtesy of an insane series of decisions by right-wingers on the Supreme Court that you can track right back to 1973 when Richard Nixon put Lewis Powell on the court, of the infamous Powell memo. And if you know not of what I'm speaking, Google it, please. It is worth reading. And be careful, because there are right-wing sites out there, and many of them disguised as totally neutral, and right-wingers scrubbing Wikipedia constantly. But the Board of Canvassers in the state of Michigan, their job is to make sure that things that are on the ballot are legit. I mean, that's what the Board of Canvassers does, right? Is this candidate legitimate? Is this issue legitimate? Are these petitions legitimate? Are these actual voters who signed these? You had to have 160,000 voters. They brought in 220,000 petitions on the assumption that some of the people who signed them said that they were registered voters when, in fact, they weren't. So you got 220,000 of these petitions. They look them over and say, yeah, okay, these are fine. We'll put it on the ballot in November. And, you know, the one question I'm not sure of, and I should have asked Tony, this is a good one, is, are these guys stalling for this to be, I mean, is it possible that this appeals court can take so long that even if they decide, yeah, it is 14-point type, the ballots are legible, the ballots should be legal, they should go ahead and do it, that it'll be too late to put it on the ballot? Or it'll be too late to do the certification of all the ballots. I mean, this is mind-boggling. Two Republicans, two Democrats on the Board of Canvassers, and 40 minutes before this thing is decided, a group comes forward which is registered at the same address as one of these two Republicans on the Board of Canvassers and says, excuse me, the state law says that this has to be 14-point type. Now, the printer has sworn an affidavit under threat of perjury that it's 14-point type, but we don't think it is, so we'd like to challenge the petitions. The petitions to do away with Public Act 4, which Tony and I didn't even talk about. Public Act 4 is the law which was rammed through the House and Senate in the state of Michigan by Governor Rick Snyder and his Republican cronies that says that And by the way, it was put into immediate effect illegally, unconstitutionally. That says that the governor has the power to go into a city and say, your city's not run well, I'm going to put one of my buddies in charge, pay him a couple $100,000 a year, and he gets to sell off your assets. And they did that with Benton Harbor, Michigan. And there was a park that back in the 19-aughts, or the 19-teens, had been given to the city in perpetuity on the one condition that it always be available for the people of the city, by a fairly, you know, family that owned this land. They wanted to leave it to the city. And the city manager, the emergency manager, excuse me, the little dictator appointed by Rick Snyder, comes in and says, oh, wow, look at this beachfront property, and it butts right up to this golf course. Let's take it from the city, from the people of the city, and sell it to the golf course. And we'll use that money to put into the city coffers, which can pay my salary. Or can pay taxes to the state government that pays my salary, however it works. That was Public Act 4. Public Act 4 says that the governor can undo democracy. We have had on this show numerous times one of the city council members from the city of Benton Harbor who told this tragic story on the air of how the people of the city of Benton Harbor elected him to serve in a democratic, small-d democratic way, the way that was envisioned by the founders of this country who fought and died for the right to vote, to have elected officials represent you. He was elected to represent his part of Benton Harbor. And what happens? The governor says, we don't like how it's run. you no longer have any power. Even though the city charter says you do, even though the state constitution says you do, we passed this law and we put it into immediate effect illegally that says that I can tell you to take a hike. So you can meet, but you can't meet in the official offices. You can meet in the church basement. And you can make laws and proclamations, but they don't have any power because the dictator is running the city now. You get this? Do you get how weird this is, how wrong this is? And down in Florida, Rick Scott is pulling people off the voting rolls, saying, oh, well, they must not be citizens. There must be hundreds of thousands of people in this state who registered to vote, and they're not citizens. Right. I can tell you, you know, when Arizona started seriously cracking down on people who were there illegally, what happened? People fled the state. There's a net negative emigration out of Mexico right now. There's more people going to Mexico than coming here. The last thing somebody who is in this country illegally wants to do is walk into a county election office or a city election office and say, hi, my name is Tom Hartman and I'm not a citizen. Or my name is Tom Hartman and I am a citizen. And commit a felony in saying so. The last thing. Except this is the canard. This is the lie that Governor Rick Scott down in Florida. I'm pretty sure Rick Snyder in Michigan will do it next if he could hang on. I mean, this is coming to a state near you. Trust me.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, election stuff is not the only stuff in the news. There's actually a fascinating story that Jason Leopold has pulled together for truthout.org, lead investigative reporter over at Truthout, and a self-admitted news junkie. Jason Leopold, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. And Jason, I just found this amazing. This from hopeful immigrant to FBI informant, the inside story of the other Abu Zubaydah. Now, most of us, when we hear the name Abu Zubaydah, we think, okay, isn't that the name of, like, you know, one of the high value detainees? Wasn't he like some big shot in Al Qaeda, et cetera? I don't think most people are like such, you know, junkies about this stuff that they would even know exactly who he is. So why don't you fill us in and give us the story, you know, assuming no information.
Yes, he's a very important figure in the sense that he was the first high-value detainee captured after 9/11 in Pakistan. He is the detainee who appears in that infamous August 2001 presidential daily brief warning Bush that Bin Laden is determined to strike in the U.S. Abu Zubaydah appears in the torture memo, the infamous John Yoo J. Bybee torture memo that authorized the Bush administration to use so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. In fact, the torture program itself was built around Abu Zubaydah. The Bush administration at one point claimed that he was the number two, the number three, person in Al-Qaeda, a lieutenant to Osama bin Laden. The Justice Department, virtually no one realizes this, has recanted all of those the assertions that the Bush administration made about his value, if you will.
Really?
So, yeah, they did that 2 years ago in a court filing, which I reported on a couple of years ago, and they no longer stand behind those statements.
And when you say the Justice Department, the FBI is part of the Justice Department.
Correct. I mean, the FBI sort of separate in terms of, you know, what they'll say,
right.
But for the purposes of his habeas corpus case, which his attorneys, you know, are still litigating in D.C. Circuit, the Justice Department says that their understanding of Abu Zubaydah has evolved over time.
Okay, so but you know, how did he? How did he? Pardon me. For, you know, we have five more minutes, but I just have to know this. How, if he is not a high value guy, how is he in the prophetic memo on August 6, 2001? You know, that basically predicted 9/11 that caused George Bush to extend his vacation and then go to Florida because he was afraid to go to D.C.
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Tom. They at the time, that's what they, you know, the Bush administration claimed they believed him to be.
Yeah, okay. So back to the story.
I'm sorry?
Back to the story of Abu Zubaydah and his brother.
So it was during the course of research I was doing on Abu Zubaydah a year ago that I stumbled across a comment left on a blog by someone who identified themselves as Hesham Abu Zubaydah, basically stating that, do you think it's fair that I've been locked away or that I was locked away in immigration prison for 2 years based on the crimes of my brother? And as I just indicated, everything we know about Abu Zubaydah comes from the government. So when I saw this comment, I was stunned, Tom. I was blown away, and I was wondering what Hesham's story was. I tracked him down to Florida. I mean, first I was stunned that he had a brother who lived in the United States, and tracked him down to Florida and, you know, spoke to him for a couple of days. And it was after my conversation with him that I realized that, you know, he has a fascinating story to tell.
This is the brother of the terrorist guy.
Exactly.
This is the brother of the guy who got tortured. And he had come to the United States seeking the American dream.
He came to the U.S. to try to pursue the American dream. He wanted to become a citizen. He married a U.S. citizen. He has kids. And unfortunately, he became collateral damage as a result of what his brother had been accused of.
Wow.
And for the past 10 years, he has been paying a high price for the crimes, the alleged crimes that his brother has committed. He later was recruited by the FBI as an informant to spy on mosques in Portland, which he agreed to do because he felt or he was led to believe that the FBI would help him obtain citizenship. That never happened. You know, you fast forward a few years. He finds himself before a grand jury. He was subpoenaed. He's testifying against his brother with the threat of going back to prison if he doesn't do so.
And now he, this guy who, do you think it's really true that he just came to the United States looking for the American dream, as opposed to, you know, I'm sure that the FBI was thinking, at least initially, this guy's a deep cover mole, right?
I think they did have those suspicions, and I do believe that's the reason that he came to the United States. You know, I spent quite a bit of time with him, and in addition to the story, there's a video interview that I did with him. You know, this is a person who actually tried to enlist in the U.S. Marines.
Wow.
Here. He tried to enlist in the Army. He wanted to prove that not only was he a good person and unlike his brother, but that he would have fought and died for this country.
So we're talking about the brother of Abu Zubaydah. We're talking with Jason Leopold, lead investigative reporter at truthout.org, this new piece that he has out, from hopeful immigrant to FBI informant, the inside story of the other Abu Zubaydah, and that being the last name. This is Hesham Abu Zubaydah.
Yeah.
And now this poor guy, I mean, if that story is true, who just wanted to be an American citizen, now he's a pariah in both communities, right? I mean, in the law enforcement community or whatever it may be, I mean, you know, in America, he's a pariah because he's the brother of this nasty guy who helped do 9/11 or is alleged to have. And within his own Muslim community, and I'm not talking about radical, you know, Al-Qaeda Muslim. I'm talking about just, you know, your average mosque.
Sure.
Since he's been an FBI informant inside mosques in Portland. I remember when that all broke. I was living in Portland. I was doing this show from there. I had no idea he was the informant. Because of that, I would guess that Muslims are shunning him. I mean, does he have anything left, any shred of his life left at all?
He really doesn't. And let me just say that in terms of the revelation about him being an FBI informant, that was not public until yesterday. He never shared that information with anyone. His wife and a few close friends, actually friends who introduced him to the FBI, are the only individuals who knew that. You know, he simply went into mosques, one particular mosque in Portland that's been under surveillance for more than a decade by the FBI, And they, you know, showed him some pictures and said, "Do you know anyone that, you know, that would be waging jihad against the United States?" And you know, he did that for a couple of years and never saw anything suspicious. But, you know, to answer your question, I think that after this is out, sure, I think that's certainly one of his fears.
Did you release this information with his consent?
Yes. In okay. fact, not only did I release it with his consent, Tom, he signed an authorization form that permitted me to file a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI seeking his case file. It was as a result of that FOIA request that I filed that led the FBI to pay him a personal visit last August, which is the subject of a separate story that was also published yesterday in which the FBI agent talked to him about me, about my FOIA request, wanted to know what he told me, why he wanted this information out there. Somewhat of an unprecedented move, mind you. And I have embedded the documents in the story so people can read it. So there's quite a bit of concern, you know, from federal law enforcement, obviously, that, you know, one of their former informants is, quote, going south. That's what happens when
when they get out.
The term used. Yeah.
Jason Leopold, you should be, you should very quickly write a screenplay about this, because I think Steven Spielberg could turn this into a hell of a movie. Jason Leopold, truthout.org. You read all about it. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you very much, Tom. I appreciate it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And once again, you can read the whole story, Jason Leopold's story, over at truthout.org, exclusive to that website. It's an amazing, like I said, this would make a movie. This is an amazing story. Yes, Shane says, a bumper for Jason Leopold. You report on Abu Zubaydah, the FBI is going to be watching you. It is an amazing story, though. It's fascinating, and it's also a demonstration of the kind of good old-fashioned journalism that just doesn't happen much in the United States anymore. We are so uninformed about what we're doing, about what our government's doing, about what's happening in the world. It's really a tragedy. You know, it's really a tragedy. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Esteban in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening on AM 950. Hey, Esteban, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've been listening to your show for several years, and I'm an immigrant, too. I've been in this country for 10 years. I just recently received my citizenship, and now finally I'm going to be able to vote. But I want to make a comment about what you were talking about at the beginning of your show when you were saying that immigrants don't take the risk about voting, and that's completely true. You were spot on that. I've been here for a whole decade, and I never actually heard of anybody. I know tons of immigrants, and I never heard anybody would take the risk of going and voting, knowing they are not allowed to do so.
Yeah, you not only do you lose any chance of ever becoming a citizen, but you can go to prison or be deported. Who wants to do that?
Nobody wants to take that risk. I mean, I've been here for 10 years. I've been eager to vote. I mean, I've seen how these people go into office and lie to you in your face, and I wanted to vote, be part of it. I'm finally unable to do so, and I had never crossed my mind to actually go and take the risk of voting when I wasn't allowed. It just doesn't happen. You don't need to spend millions and millions of dollars just to know that. You can go and ask anybody.
Yeah, yeah. It's well, thank you for your testimony, Esteban, and welcome.
One more thing, if you let me for another second here.
Sure.
That's not only happening in Florida. It's happening here in Minnesota, right? Not long ago, the legislature passed a provision for the ballot that is going to allow to amend the Constitution to require ID to actually vote in this state. So it's not only happening there. It's also happening here in this state. So I just hope that the voters of Minnesota don't allow that to happen. I think that would be really bad for our democracy.
As now we have reached the point where more than half of all the babies born in the United States are not white, the Republicans understand that the only way that they can hold on to power for another generation is to stop people from voting. And that's what it's all about. So in any case, Esteban, congratulations on doing what my father's father did when he came to this country, and that is becoming a naturalized U.S. citizen. I honor your efforts and your citizenship, and welcome to our country, to your country. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. And keep doing this. It's a great job that you're doing. I've been listening to you for many, many years. It's the first time I call. And I've been learning a lot. I think I haven't learned. I'm going to school right now, but I haven't learned as much as I've just listening to your show. It's a great education for anybody, for new immigrants, and for actually for citizens here in the U.S. too.
Thank you, Esteban. Thank you for your kind words. And thanks for listening to AM 950 there in Minneapolis. Cora in Taos, New Mexico, listening on KVOT. Hey, Cora, what's up?
Hi. Well, I was going to tell you about a story I heard on NPR this morning, and it was about Michigan, and it was about a petition on a ballot, but it was something else.
You mean they were not reporting on the fact that on the 14-point type kerfuffle? Okay.
No. This was a Republican senator, and I can't remember his name, but originally he decided he was going to jump on the bandwagon and run for president, and of course he sank like a stone. So he decided he better get back on the ballot for senator. And, of course, by this time, another Republican has, you know, put his name in the hat. But anyway, he thought, well, you only have to collect 1,000 signatures to get on the ballot.
May I interrupt you? Is this in the race against Debbie Stabenow that Pete Hoekstra is running?
His last name started with an M, and I can't remember who his Republican opponent is.
Yeah, because Pete Hoekstra is the guy who, you know, famously ran that ad where the Chinese-looking woman says, thank you, Debbie Stabenow, for sending our jobs overseas, which was such a horrible lie that Pete Hoekstra ended up, you know, apologizing for. In the last day or so, he's come out with another outrageous xenophobic statement.
I don't know. Maybe it could have been his name. I didn't catch it.
Yeah. I think he's the only – I'm pretty sure that's the only – you know, there's only two senators in Michigan, and the elections are staggered by either 2 or 4 years. So it would pretty much have to be that race. Anyhow, back to you. You were saying.
Well, so anyway, he's got another opponent for the Republican, you know, ballot.
Right.
And he only had to get 1,000 names on his petition to get back on the ballot.
Right.
And so he sent in more than 1,000. Well, it turns out there was only 250 names, but they were photocopied over and over again.
You're kidding.
So they rejected the petition, and so he has to become a write-in candidate now.
Yeah, well, that kind of qualifies as being even worse than not having 14-point type.
Yeah, so, I mean, they only bothered to get 250 names. I guess they got tired or something. And anyway, somebody was busy photocopying those 250 names.
Incredible. Cora, thank you for sharing that story and for listening to KVOT. Neil, listening to AM Talk 1090 in Seattle, in Redmond, Washington. Hey, Neil, we got a minute to the break. What's up?
Hey, Tom. God, I don't even remember how long ago. About 15 minutes ago, I was listening to you, and I pulled up Google, typed in voter fraud in Florida. The first thing that pops up is Alex Jones's Information Wars.
Right.
And their take on it is a little bit different. They start by quoting Michelle Obama.
Of course.
They say, just last month, Florida election officials were denied help by the feds to confirm citizenship status and voter fraud for an estimated 180,000 illegal immigrants already registered to vote in Florida.
Amazing.
So it's the exact opposite take that your show has.
That's, you know, what astounds me. I wouldn't be surprised to hear that coming from a Republican, but Alex Jones has always represented himself as the guy who's willing to take on the unpopular conspiracies and, you know, the nasty guys and all this kind of stuff, but without a partisan bent. I'm kind of saddened, frankly, to hear that he has drunk the Republican Kool-Aid, but I'm not surprised. Neil, thank you for the call. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Alex and I even simulcast our shows together a couple years ago. We did a whole hour together, his show and my show at the same time. And, you know, I totally disagree with him, but I used to respect him. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, amazing. Danny in Hillsdale, Michigan. Hey, Danny, Michigan State Senate is up to even more than we knew about.
Yes. How you doing, Tom?
Great. Tell us about it.
Well, King Rick and his goons are at it again. So what they just drafted at the state bills here is State Bill 110, 115, well, I should say 1110, 1115, 1116, 1117, and 1118.
Mm-hmm.
They are to give the grant legal economic immunity to doctors, hospitals, and insurance companies. So you cannot sue them for anything.
Really?
In the state of Michigan, yes.
That's
it was in the Hillsdale Daily News, you know, where what we get is very right wing, so
yeah.
And it's in it, so I mean, I had to give you guys heads up.
But your right to sue is protected by the Sixth Amendment. I mean, and the Seventh Amendment.
Evidently, King Richard here don't think so.
Here, the Seventh Amendment. In suits at common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law.
Right.
You have the right to a trial by jury in any civil matter that's worth over $20. The Seventh Amendment. So where are the seventhers? We know about the tenthers and the seconders,
right.
And, you know, where are the seventhers?
Well, look at what they did in Benton Harbor and Flint.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah.
You know how these people are doing it.
Rick Snyder
is. Before the election, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Rick Snyder is trying. I mean, these guys are trying to turn democracies into oligarchies. There's just no other way to describe it.
Oh, yeah.
Turn it
over
to the rich guys.
I think they just. That's why you see all these new movies of thrones and all that. It's to get the United States people used to this.
Oh, you think that all the movies that are about kings and kingdoms and
it sure has been geared that way lately. You know,
yeah, you're right. You're right. There's been a lot of movies that have princes and princesses in them, and maybe it's because the direction our country is going. And of course, the Hunger Games is the direction the Republicans want to take the United States. Sure, yeah, you can make it in America. You can go to college. Just go off to the military and fight in a battle that we can all watch first, and then we'll pay for your college. Danny, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Mark in Las Vegas. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, yes. You know, there are only a few people who may have even attempted to vote who weren't legally able to vote. But we know that tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of legal American citizens are not going to be able to vote because of these laws drafted in 25 different states.
Yes.
This is not by accident. This is a deliberate policy.
Yes.
That they know will cause this to happen.
Promoted by the Koch brothers and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, their little Republican Love Fest crowd that, you know, where the state legislators sit side by side with lobbyists from big corporations, in some cases foreign corporations, and make new laws for the states. Yes.
Absolutely. This is not only un-American, but
it's anti-American.
It's anti-American, yes. And it's an insult to representative democracy and all these people who've worked so hard and believed in a system for all those years and will go to the polls and discover, oh, no, sorry, we don't want your vote.
Yep, I'm absolutely with you. Mark, thank you very much for the call. And Jeff in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
I'll tell you, I just can't believe this. When you were talking about NPR hasn't even come out on this.
Well, according to the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, there has been no national, outside of, you know, a couple of shows, the evening progressive shows. I'm assuming Ed Schultz has covered it. I'll be on his show tonight, by the way, and I've heard specifically that Rachel Maddow has covered it.
Those are
cable shows. Those are, you know, when you look at the big networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, if you look at the big national newspaper, you know, which have tens of millions of viewers, the big newspapers with millions of readers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, no mention.
That should be on the headlines in the New York Times today.
I would think. Yeah. You know, they're getting ready to steal Florida 6 months in advance, or 5.5 months, whatever it is. They're getting ready to steal Florida right now.
And sometimes I wonder how President Obama must feel, because I really did a lot, you know, to get him in,
yeah,
as far as, and I don't
and
agree
he did
with everything he's done, but I think he's a pretty good guy, and these multi-billionaires can just, I don't feel like I live in a democracy anymore, and I fought for my country in Vietnam.
Oh, my. Well, you know, here's what, in 1773, when the British Parliament passed the Tea Act of 1773, which gave a multi-million dollar, in today's dollars, it would be hundreds of billions of dollar tax break to the British East India Company so that they could dump tea, and by dump I mean sell at prices lower than the local vendors, dump tea in the U.S. market and wipe out small entrepreneurs and wipe out small smugglers, they called them.
Smugglers, really?
Yeah. And you know, when the British did that, when this corrupt piece of legislation that was done to benefit the largest corporation in the world, the people of Boston, before they tossed the tea in the harbor and the Boston Tea Party, in the weeks leading up to that, what they started to do, and I've got, I don't have a copy within hand reach, so I can't grab it, but it's fine. It would take me too long to find it anyway, but I quote all this stuff in my book on equal protection. What the people of Boston did is they started, and not just Boston, this was all up and down the East Coast, from Charlotte all the way up to New York. They started publishing leaflets and nailing them to trees in the middle of the night, saying, you know, beware of the East India Company, that perfidious tea is coming, you know, boycott the East India Company, you know, et cetera. And they got, you know, more and more insistent, but they outed the British government for what they had done, and they outed the East India, mostly the East India Company. Most of these flyers were about the East India Company. And we need to be doing the same thing on the blogs that are attached to news stories, saying, you know, going down to the New York Times and there's a news story about anything that has to do with elections and say, you know, why are you not covering the fact that Florida is being stolen right now by Rick Scott? Why are you not covering the fact that in Michigan, Rick Snyder has turned back democracy and said no? And you know, we need to be posting our pamphlets on the trees all around us, which is largely cyberspace. Make sense?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
thank you.
Unfortunately, I'm pretty sick, you know. So,
but Jeff, you can still
so much.
You can still use a computer, and you can still, you know, at least call your member of Congress and say, you know, hey, can you do something about this? I mean, Congress should pass a law making this illegal. Jeff, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Van, listening on AM 760 in Longmont, Colorado. Hey, Van, what's up?
Well, you know, my question is that, you know, I'm 45 years old, and, you know, the first time I didn't vote in my life was in 2010. And, you know, I'm wondering when all of this just blows up. I mean, the United States typically kind of tolerates, and then something happens, and, you know, we go through a convulsion. You know,
yeah, you know, something that happens is usually an economic crash. There was one in 1773, there was one in 1857. There was one in 1897. There was one in 1929, and we're in the midst of one right now. With very, very fragile fingers, the Obama administration is holding above the ground. You know, is keeping it from falling, and the Republicans are doing everything they can to pry those fingers apart.
Right, and what I'm wondering though is, like, you know, the riots in Los Angeles, you know, in '92.
Yeah.
You know, ostensibly those were about Rodney King, but I think they had a lot to do with just what was going on economically,
sure.
And that was kind of the camel that broke the back, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back. And I feel like we're at a tipping point in, you know, again, but I feel like we're a heck of a lot higher up in the air.
Yep, I agree.
You know, I'm wondering, you know, you're talking about, you know, trying to hold on to power for another generation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the harder the squeeze, they squeeze, the bigger the explosion's going to be. And it's going to come. No authoritarian, nobody has held on to power with power. It just never, ever works.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
History of mankind.
It may happen for a few generations, but not for multiple generations.
Right. So if we're 30 years into this cycle and they can hold on for another 30 years, you know, what's going to happen? I mean, when are people going to wake up to the fact?
I think in an absolute autocracy, when there is a broad consensus that autocracy is acceptable, that it's possible to hold on to power for multiple generations. I forget who it was, but it was a brilliant philosopher some years ago pointed out that revolutions happen not when the level of pain gets so high people rebel. That's not what causes revolutions. because there are people in pain all around the world that is far greater than anything you or I could even imagine. Revolutions happen when there is a rapid separation between what people expect for themselves and their future and their children and what they actually realize they're going to have. And when that gap in expectations reaches a certain width, then you have revolutions. And I'm not talking necessarily about violent revolutions. I consider what Franklin Roosevelt did, the New Deal, a revolution. That's when you have radical transformation of society. And I think we were there in 2008, and I think that that's what Obama campaigned on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Obstruction from the Republicans over the last 3 years that he hasn't been able to deliver on it. And the question is, with this election, will it be possible for him to? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, this is interesting. Valerie Espinoza is running for the Public Regulation Commission in District 3. Is that in the Phoenix area, Ellen?
No, that's in New Mexico.
In New Mexico. I'm sorry.
Yes, parts of Albuquerque, I guess.
Oh, we're on the air in Albuquerque.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, Valerie, I wish you the very best. And if you can vote for Valerie Espinoza for Public Regulation Commission District 3, you will do well. The vote is on June 5th, by the way.
I'll be there. I'm going to report from New Mexico.
Oh, how cool. Okay, great. We can talk about it on the air. Our Talk Radio News Service report is brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service here in the studio with us. Hey, Ellen.
Well, thank you. Actually, I think you're going to get Bob Ney tomorrow on the phone.
I love Bob.
Yes. Well,
Bob is, even if he was a Republican, yeah. I have so much respect for Bob.
Well, he's doing some pretty cool things, and you know we're doing his book in the fall.
No, I didn't know that. You're going to publish his book. Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, it's going to be.
Is it going to ruffle some Republican feathers?
It's going to ruffle some feathers. Let's put it that way. I don't want to get too much into the feathers, but.
Okay.
You'll get an advanced copy. Okay. The House is in session. It just got into session this afternoon, and they're going to do a reauthorization of the FDA, what the FDA actually charges companies to do the drug approval process. As you know, we can go back and forth about that.
Mm-hmm.
But then they need this two-thirds vote because they're going under what's called suspension of the rules. And what do they want to do? They want to outlaw selective abortions, people who want to abort their child because they're female or male or that kind of thing.
Right, but they're doing it under suspension of the rules, which means what they really want is a symbolic vote.
Well, that's right, because they're not going to get it also.
I mean,
they're not going to get
it. It will not
that.
Pass.
That's right. And because if you start to say, well, you can't do abortions for this reason, then how are you going to prove it? I mean, it's a very messy
kind of
thing.
So the reason why the Republicans are bringing this to the floor under rules that they know will prevent it from passing, period, is that they want Democrats to vote against it so that they can run ads in November saying, did you know that Congressman Joe Blow voted to allow or refused to vote to stop people from killing their babies because they're female?
Well, that's the thing is that often suspension of the rules, I don't know if under this actually every person would be.
Oh, the votes don't get recorded.
I'm not sure they do in that way.
Oh, interesting.
Yes.
Okay.
But it's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. Speaking of not going anywhere, your friend, Rance Priebus.
My friend? I've never met the guy.
He's head of the Republican National Committee.
Yes.
He thinks that Scott Walker is going to come out of the recall election. I just have to tell you that they're, and the reason is he said that they are looking at these advanced ballots, people who have mail-in ballots.
Right, early voters.
And I think so. It's very important if people are in Wisconsin that they know that there is still time. Next Tuesday is the election. But he's also saying this is going to portend how Obama will be doing in the overall election. I mean, he's just throwing everything in that direction.
I think, though, that there's some truth to that. I mean, this election is an example of what $25 million in money from oil millionaires and billionaires in Texas and Wall Street billionaires in New York can, versus organize people on the streets. And if money wins, that's a bad sign for our democracy. We had John Nichols on this program yesterday, who lives in Madison and is a very astute reporter, for the nation. And he said that I watched Scott Walker's debate with Tom Barrett over the weekend, and I came away concluding that this guy was a brilliant politician.
Walker is a brilliant politician.
And what John Nichols said is he could be the next Ronald Reagan. Yeah. Yeah. Goosebumps.
Chills up me. Speaking of classy, though, the president called Governor Romney today. And,
oh, really?
Yes, he did. He initiated
the
call.
Because the governor released his birth certificate yesterday?
No, he congratulated him on being the nominee. He said he looks for a healthy debate on issues and was very cordial and talked about his family, and that's what the president did.
Wow.
I think that takes a lot of class.
Yeah, it does. Although Romney's advisors are telling him, look out, he's just trying to get you off balance.
Right. Well, Mr. Romney, though, also is now saying that he actually said this yesterday. He wants to arm the Syrian rebels. Of course, that is not what the White House is doing, because the White House and other countries feel that it could just turn into a worse mess.
It'll turn into a bloodbath.
It'll turn into a total bloodbath. 12 countries now, as of just an hour or two ago, have expelled the senior diplomat from Syria, so they're not going to be having too much influence around on that front.
Yeah.
Okay, Pete Hoekstra was on, I believe, CNN this morning.
Yeah.
He is running against our friend Debbie Stabenow in Michigan, and he is now saying he wants to establish, like, a birther office. No, he doesn't really question the president was born in the United States, but he wants to do this in the future.
Right.
It's quite astounding.
This is laying the groundwork stuff. This is sort of like, you know, George Bush spending $70 million and having 94, I guess, or 93 of his federal prosecutors looking for voter fraud, right? They never found it, but what it did was it established the groundwork so that right now Rick Scott in Florida can be removing people from the voting rolls.
Which is what was going on in Florida.
Yeah, because their names end with a vowel.
That's right. Also, the president signed the Export-Import Bank renewal. Now, this was actually jointly negotiated by Eric Cantor and Steny Hoyer, although Eric Cantor did not come to the signing of it. Last year alone, 290,000 jobs at 3,600 companies were responsible because XM lends money. So, for instance, I'm planning on doing this silkscreen factory in South Sudan. If I want to borrow some money and use American equipment to do this and then send it over to South Sudan, I can possibly get a loan. It really does a lot of things to make American jobs possible.
Interesting. And that's the Export-Import Bank.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
That's run by a friend of ours, Fred Hochberg, actually.
I don't know him.
Yeah. He's an openly gay member of the president's administration.
Good on him.
And also, they also said that Boeing had gotten, because of an XM loan, 200 planes went to one particular company from Boeing. And I know
that's great.
Machinist Union were there this morning as well.
Congratulations to them. Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal solidarity, stability, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. You know, I have occasionally propounded things that others have said, oh, that's a conspiracy theory, like, you know, hey, did you know that when you vote on one of those voting machines, you don't really know that you're actually voting? And they're owned by private corporations who seem to be kind of like in the Mitt Romney camp these days, and we're in the George Bush camp. Is that a conspiracy theory? I don't think so. Now, I'm not saying that there is fraud. I think personally that there has been. I mean, you know, if banks had unlocked back doors, do you think that any would ever get robbed? Maybe occasionally. So tell me again about secure computers. You ever heard of Julian Assange? Occasionally I have been known to wander into the realm of, You know, even odd things. You know, why did the Republicans turn the stars upside down on their logo? Why did they go for the international distress sign or the satanic star back when George Bush was running for president? I don't know the answer to that. I have asked probably 100 Republicans that question, and nobody has answered it. Nobody, you know, from Ken Blackwell, seriously, from Ken Blackwell to Republican, I've asked all kinds. Nobody knows. If you know, let me know. But there are some people who say that, oh, well, you know, in some forms, the Republican stars have been upside down for even longer than since 2000. Why? Oh, because it's that way in the Medal of Honor or something, some star, some military star. Well, that's because you got to hang that star by two hooks. You know, if it's going to hang from your chest, if you're a general or something, and or whatever. You know, if you're in that medal. But that doesn't explain why on a logo, which doesn't hang from any hooks, they would not use the stars that Betsy Ross put on her flag. But the question that I want to ask, the ultimate conspiracy theory, is could it be, now listen to this carefully, consider this for a moment, could it be that the billionaires and the banksters who are so heavily bankrolling the Republican Party and the, in particular, the Republicans like Eric Cantor and, you know, his buddies in the House and Senate who are trying to force this debt limit crisis before the election, could it be that they're doing it not just because it will politically hurt President Obama and the Democrats, principally President Obama, but could it be that they're doing it because it will make them money? Now just think about this for a minute. When the government borrows money, it does so by issuing things called treasury bills or treasury bonds, treasury notes. They're IOUs. You can buy them. You and I, we can buy them directly from the government. You can buy them through banks. You can buy funds. TLT is one of them, the, you know, publicly traded funds of treasuries. You can buy them in one-year denominations, 10s, 20s, and 30-year, as I recall. I'm not a big bond guy, but, you know, maybe only 20 years, but whatever. You can buy these bonds in these various forms. And when you own, say you own a $10,000 treasury bond, treasury pays you a little bit of interest every month or every year. Right now, what our federal government is paying in interest is around 1.7%. And the reason it's so low is because everybody knows that our government's going to pay back the bill. Now, similarly, everybody knows Germany's going to pay back the bill. But German bonds right now, Germany is borrowing money to operate their government at only 1.36%. So why does America have to pay more than Germany to get people to buy its debt? Well, the reason why, in large part, has to do with what happened last year when the Republicans forced a debt crisis. They said, you know, there is nothing in the Constitution that says that the borrowing power of the United States government is limited. In fact, it says that it's entirely up to Congress. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, you can read it. But back in the 1950s, there were a bunch of Republicans in Congress. You had a Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower, and Vice President Richard Nixon. And there were a bunch of Republicans in Congress who wanted to make sure that there was never again a Franklin Roosevelt. Now, what was the crime that Franklin Roosevelt committed? He borrowed money in the name of the federal government by selling treasury bills. He borrowed money and used that borrowed money to put people to work. The WPA, the CCC, the Rural Works Administration, the Rural Telephony Administration, all these alphabet agencies. The federal government became the employer of last resort, and the people were paid with money that had been borrowed. Now, that money came back into the federal treasury over the next decade as the economy recovered, because people then started working in private industry, paying taxes. Private industry is paying taxes. By the time of the Eisenhower administration, about a third of all the revenue coming into the federal government was coming from corporations. Now it's about 7%. But in any case, These Republicans, they wanted to make sure that there was never again an FDR, somebody who would borrow money and use it for social good. So they passed a law saying that, you know, okay, there's a $1 trillion debt right now. If the Congress wants to go above that, it requires an act of Congress to raise the debt ceiling. We're going to put a ceiling on the debt. Again, it's not in the Constitution. The founders would not have liked this idea at all. But Congress did this to itself. And actually what they did is they did it to the president. And it was their way of saying, if anybody comes along and thinks that he's going to play FDR, not on our watch. And again, the Democrats didn't much care about this. This was a Republican initiative. And therefore, when Ronald Reagan came in and he tripled the national debt, he took us from $1 trillion to $3 trillion, which in today's money, you know, would be almost $10 trillion, arguably. It's just a massive increase in federal debt that Ronald Reagan did. The Republicans very happily raised the debt limit 9 times in Reagan's 8 years in office. Never questioned it. Oh, yeah, Jude Winski, 2 Santa Clauses. Yes, raise the debt. Jack up the debt as hard and fast and high as you can while the Republicans in office. So when Bill Clinton comes into office, when a Democrat comes into office, we can all start screaming about the debt and force him to shoot Santa Claus, you know, kill off welfare as we know it, for example. But anyhow, back to the Treasury bills. So when the Republicans said last year, we will not raise the debt ceiling because of this funky law that was passed in the 50s by Republicans, we will not raise the debt ceiling unless, President Obama, you dial back unemployment benefits from 99 weeks to 54 weeks. And they compromised at 73, as I recall. So basically, the Republicans said, we will not raise the debt ceiling. We will not let you borrow more money and keep the government operating unless you throw a bunch of people off unemployment, which happened. The president said, okay, I'll go along with that compromise. He had no choice. The only way to get it out of the House of Representatives, controlled by the Republicans. What happened? As a result of that standoff, the credit rating agencies downgraded our debt, which raised the interest we pay. Now, the millionaires and billionaires are heavily invested in treasuries. In fact, I understand some of them are starting to sell their gold now and move the money into treasuries. And they're talking now about having another debt ceiling crisis. Now, Spain is having a debt crisis right now, and there's some concern that Spain may not be able to pay their debts, which is what would happen if the Republicans froze up things here. Spain's interest rate just went up to 7.3%. So the millionaires and billionaires in Spain are making good money on Spanish treasury bills. So could it be that one of the reasons that these big fat cat funders of the Republicans who are threatening to crash our economy again, one of the reasons that they're doing it is because the interest paid by the United States, the interest rate will go from 1.7% up to 2 or 2.5%. And suddenly they're making, you know, if you've got billions of dollars in treasuries, you're making a lot more money. Could be.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I realize it sounds a little esoteric, but sometimes rich people are trying to make more money, not to get political power, but just to make more money.
The Cokes would like to buy the world and make it all their own. It's grown too full of free ideas to really feel like home. Let's focus on the simple things like lower tax for all, and hope no one notices where the greatest benefit will fall. Yes, we.
Yes, the greatest benefit goes to the billionaires. So if they can damage the full faith and trust of the United States, if they can cause, if they can force Congress for just 1 hour to not pay the interest payments on U.S. Treasury bills, the proverbial stalemate, which John Boehner is talking about doing. Now, the president has said that he's going to be able to run the government without raising the debt ceiling until January, until after the election. But John Boehner has said he's going to force a vote on this in August. Why? Why would he do this? Well, if he does, I mean, the last time he did this, it degraded our credit rating, which jacked up the interest rates that our government has to pay, which A, makes our debt worse, because it makes the annual deficit worse, because we have to spend more on interest payments, And B, where's that interest money going? It's going to the millionaires and billionaires. I mean, there's literally billions of dollars in U.S. debt that is held by very wealthy people in the United States. When George W. Bush was born, he had a trust fund in the millions of dollars in treasuries. I mean, it used to be part of his official bio. Or some bio. I read it in one of his biographies. So it's like the billionaires will make out really good if the Republicans can damage our economic standing. Plus, they get to say, see, I told you so. The president can't, the president is impotent. He can't get something through Congress. Or he's a big borrower and spender or something like that. I think that there might be an end game here or a second tier to this game that isn't quite so visible to all of us. Willis in Mesa, Arizona. Hey, Willis,
yes,
what's on your mind?
Yes, sir.
What's up?
How you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Excuse me?
We are on the air. What's on your mind?
Okay. How you doing, sir?
Very well, thank you.
First and foremost, you know what I'm saying, I want to give a shout out from Arizona to the whole Free Speech program. Two-part question, Tom.
Sure.
Do you think our economy would sustain till January the 1st? And if not, what do you think the common man or woman should do to take precautionaries to endure whatever?
Yeah. I think that in all probability, our economy is going to limp along for another year or two, and then it's probably going to we're going to see a stock market crash, and it might happen earlier than that. I mean, the housing stock, the housing inventory, big report today, new home sales are dropping. Not new home sales, but homes for sale are dropping. Those numbers are dropping. That's back in 2007 when I was warning people on this program to get out of the stock market because it was going to crash. The thing that caused me to say that was that housing starts were down. In fact, they were down over 30%. And the last time we'd seen housing starts down more than 30% was 1927. And that preceded the Great Depression. And so, we're not out of this thing by any means. And the president, with his very best efforts, has not been able to follow Paul Krugman's advice. And so, as to what to do about it, I think that, either paying off as much debt as you possibly can and getting yourself debt-free, or else getting so in debt up to your eyeballs that it doesn't matter and you can walk away and just say to hell with it and to hell with my credit rating and, just reinvent your life. The people who get hurt the most are the people who are in between those two extremes. They're the people who are going to continue making their mortgage payments because they've got, $30,000, $40,000 bucks equity in their house and they're just hanging on by their fingernails. They're the ones that are totally stressed out and totally wired by the experience. I would encourage people, grow gardens. I mean, Michelle Obama is encouraging that, not because she's concerned about the economy, but because it's healthy. But, if in times of instability, I lived in Detroit in the early 70s when Nixon was president and they cut off the oil, the Arab oil embargo, and all of a sudden the stores were empty of food because the Teamsters went on strike over this thing and the food delivery stopped. So, I would prepare for that. I don't want to sound totally apocalyptic or Glenn Beck-like. I'm not sure I'd go all Mormon and buy a year's worth of food. But, I would store up some stuff, and I would either try to get, like I said, either debt-free or totally maxed out. Does that make any sense, Willis?
Yes, sir. Thank you, man.
And please do not take that as an investment advice. I have made some of the worst investments of anybody I know. One of my brothers is a great investor. I'm a lousy investor. Let me add to that. I think one of the most important things we can do is get politically active in movement politics, because when the cow pies hit the fan, as they say, the politics in America are going to be thrown up in the air, and whoever's on the ground ready to catch it is going to catch it and run with it. And I think it's really important for us to remember that the Great Depression hit the United States and Germany equally. And we had the good luck of having Harry Truman as our president rather than somebody like Adolf Hitler that Germany had. And so politics is important. Leadership is important. And leadership only happens when the people are with you. And, you know, for a whole variety of reasons that it would take too long to get into, but it started with the Treaty of Versailles. The German people were with Hitler, at least in the early 30s, and the American people were with FDR. And these two countries chose very, very different paths. And I think that if we want this country to come out of the next crisis with a new variation on the New Deal and rebuild the country and rebuild our manufacturing and pull people back together and help people put their lives back together and build a new middle class, it's going to take all of us, all hands on deck. It's going to take all of us participating. And that means go to like Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org, or democracyforamerica.com, Jim Dean's organization. Tim Carpenter runs Progressive Democrats of America. These are unaffiliated groups. They're not affiliated with any political party directly, and they're doing the ground game. And that ground game is so important. MoveOn.org, there's a bunch of them. Van Jones has got one. That I would get active with those two, Willis. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Not to sound too apocryphal, I think the probability of just all-out chaos is very small. I think that the probability of a crash is quite large. That's the good, the bad, and the very, very pergamaneously ugly. The good, Beto O'Rourke, the Democratic candidate, beat Congressman Sylvester Reyes in the Texas Democratic primary last night, becoming the third outside challenger to beat an incumbent this primary season. Congressman Reyes has been plagued by corruption scandals, specifically over benefits his family received from his political connections, and has received thousands of dollars in contributions from the military-industrial complex and other big businesses. On the other hand, O'Rourke ran on a platform of cleaning up Congress and also supports pot legalization and sensible drug policies. Corrupt lawmakers, be they Democratic or Republican, should be removed from Washington if America is going to get back on track. The bad. Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown locked in a heated battle with Elizabeth Warren for Ted Kennedy's former Massachusetts Senate seat. Republican Brown released a new campaign ad yesterday. In it, Brown talks about his strong bipartisan record, his deciding vote on Wall Street reform, which, by the way, any senator could have claimed, and his role in creating stronger ethics laws for Congress. Yeah, he voted for it. So what's wrong with this picture? Well, despite saying that he was the tie-breaking vote on Wall Street reform, Brown has taken thousands in donations from Wall Street and big financial institutions. Just another misinformation campaign coming from the right. Pay no attention to that droid. And the very, very ugly Florida Governor Rick Scott. Despite being busy throwing thousands of eligible voters off the state's voting rolls, Governor Scott is still finding time to destroy Florida's environment and punish those who are trying to protect it. Connie Bursock, the state's top wetlands expert, was suspended last week after she denied a permit to a company for a controversial and harmful business development project in Florida's wetlands. Of course, Governor Scott is all about protecting the interests of big business, so Bursock's actions had to be punished. With his war on voting, his massive cuts to education, and now his attacks on the state's environment, Governor Scott is single-handedly trying to destroy the state of Florida and ruin the lives of Floridians, and that is very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. Kathy in Chicago. Hey, Kathy, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
And I'm a first-time caller. I've never called into a program before, but this Wisconsin election feels so important.
Mm-hmm.
I just had to call and ask you a question.
Sure.
Months ago, I heard you mention Scott Walker's record of nefarious activities at Marquette when he ran for student body president, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
And then shortly after dropped out and never graduated. I'm just really puzzled as to why no one, especially Ed Schultz, you know, who is so devoted to the cause, is bringing this to light.
First of all, I can't speak for Ed. I understand. He's a good guy, but we don't organize our talking points or anything. Yeah. Secondly, I personally, I would think, you know, if I was going to burn through some ad dollars or some precious airtime, I would much rather use it talking about his current policies and how destructive they've been to Wisconsin, rather than whether or not as a you know 19 or 20 year old he screwed up in college. Because
well,
I, you know, and let me tell you, as a teenager, I screwed up in college. So, you know, I live in this glass house here. That's why I'm not throwing stones.
Well, I understand that, and I think obviously his current behavior is far more important than his behavior back in his early 20s. However, it just seems to me that if someone could clearly articulate this narrative, it says a lot about his character, and that the kinds of activities he's engaging in now are almost identical
to
the kinds.
Well, here's the piece that could fit together and make that a coherent narrative, Kathy, and you might want to take this and run with it, and you know do something on blogs and Facebook and call into shows and things. But there's a report today, and I'm pretty sure I saw it at the Think Progress blog, thinkprogress.org, although it might have been someplace else. I read about a dozen websites every day. But there's a report out that Scott Walker just moved over $100,000 out of his campaign fund, which is very well funded. He's got, you know, $25 million he's raised from the Koch brothers and people like them. He moved $100,000 out of that fund and into a fund to pay for legal defense.
Right. Yes, I know.
And nobody knows what he has to defend himself against. There's this John Doe investigation that has hit several people around him, but has not yet hit him. And, you know, the best guess is right now, I mean, the election's next Tuesday, that probably the day after the election or the week after the election, we're going to discover that one of the loci of this investigation, the focuses of this investigation, is Scott Walker. And
so,
you know, that's something that I think should be highlighted and should be publicized. I haven't done much with it today. I mentioned it in the first hour in passing, but it largely because I don't have any more information on it than that.
Are you familiar with the website dissidentvoice.org?
Yes, I haven't been there in a while, but yeah, I'm familiar with it.
There's several articles, and one really good one that came out May 23rd that really lays all of this out. It's written by a classmate of Scott Walker's.
Mm-hmm.
He was 2 years ahead of Walker, but
right.
Obviously very involved in student government and so on. And he lays it all out very clearly, and
yeah.
I just wish somehow to be brought into the light.
Yeah. The past is very often a predictor of the future. I mean, people do change from time to time, but the rule is generally that people don't, barring some kind of, you know, life crisis or major growing up experience. And I would guess that Scott Walker is probably pretty much the same person he's always been. And so, therefore your narrative has some power, but still, the question of, okay, if he was involved in shady deals when he was a kid, is he involved in shady deals now? I mean, you know, that's something for the voters of Wisconsin to decide. But it's good to bring up, and I encourage you to dig a little deeper and see what you can find, and give us a call back if you get anything, okay?
I will. I hope that Ed can some. I have tried to get through to him, but I just couldn't.
Yeah, he does. And, he does a very good job of covering Wisconsin as well.
He really does.
Yep.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Kathy, thank you. I appreciate the call. Carol in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Carol, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to point out another little trick that Rick Scott is pulling in Florida that it looks to me like it's clearly an effort to undermine motor voter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you want to get your driver's license renewed, you've got to bring your birth certificate, passport, or naturalization papers,
right.
Your Social Security card, or a W-2 or other IRS form that has the entire number written on it. You've got to bring anything that would account for a name change, like marriage license or just arbitrary
all
name
of that
change.
Stuff?
And plus two official legal documents showing that your current address is correct.
Wow.
And there's also a questionnaire that they expect you to go online and fill out before you report for your license.
Yeah.
I just thought I'd leave that with you.
Amazing. Amazing. You know, Florida's not the only state that's doing this, Carol.
No, I'm sure it's not.
It's getting harder and harder. First of all, they say, oh, you've got to have ID to vote. Oh, you want ID? Well, jump through these hoops. And what that does is it discourages anybody who's not, you know, who doesn't actually have to have a car. You know, I don't have a car, for example. I live in D.C. They've got a great, we've got a great metropolitan, you know, subway system here. It works really,
yeah,
really well. I use it
there
every single day. Yeah, so you know. And, you know, if I didn't need a driver's license to get through airports, and I suppose I could use my passport, you know, I wouldn't have one. Although, you know, you never know when you might have to hop in a car and drive someplace, so it's probably a good thing to have. But there are a lot of people who live in this city who, frankly, can't afford a car. And,
oh, absolutely.
And so, you know, why go down and get a driver's license? I mean, you know, it's just, and those are the people that they're going to say, no, sorry, you can't vote. Carol, thank you for the information. As tragic as it is, appreciate the call,
sure.
And thank
mm-hmm.
you very much. Ramon in Silver Springs, Maryland. Hey, Ramon, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to, you know, quickly touch on a couple of things. No, number one, Rick Scott's, you know, purging people off the voter rolls in Florida. We've seen systematic rollback of voting rights, and just it seems to me that the entire Democratic Party has just folded and is allowing the Republicans to run roughshod over us. I mean, you know, we look at what's going on in Wisconsin. We look at what's going on in the southern states.
The Democrats find themselves caught in a bit of a catch-22, because if they run around saying, oh, look at what Rick Scott's doing, he's trying to purge the voter rolls, then Rick Scott will say, no, I'm just trying to remove the illegal aliens. And then all of a sudden the national dialogue becomes, are there illegal aliens? How do we stop the illegal aliens? What are we going to do about the illegal aliens? And the Democrats are back, you know. It's the Republicans have set this meme up very carefully, very well, and they've spent a decade doing it, and they've spent a lot of money on this thing. You know, there are entire think tanks in here in Washington D.C. devoted to this issue, issuing policy papers, going on talk shows, showing up on Sean Hannity's program on Fox News. I mean, all of these guys, they're all about this stuff, and so the Democrats, I think, with some justification, are saying, rather than grabbing a hold of that hot wire, rather than grabbing a hold of that 170,000 volt wire, we're going to talk about the Republican efforts to destroy Social Security or to privatize Medicare. Think of things that are simple, understandable, and everybody gets, and not give the Republicans a larger platform to promote this. But in the process, as you correctly point out, the Democrats give up the game, because the Republicans then start ripping people off the voting roll. So it's a really tough one, Ramon. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Michigan and Florida voter fraud. Suzanne in Corinth, Vermont, has some thoughts on it right after this.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay.
And Shane, who's running our board today, tells me that his girlfriend just told him that NPR at the top of the hour mentioned the massive voter purge that's going on down in Florida. Finally. It'll be really interesting to see what happens with this. Very interesting. Joe in Omaha, Nebraska. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
You know, it's funny that you should say that about Shane and that info he just got about NPR. That's exactly what my question was to you and everyone listening. I'm wondering why are and how are these groups that are taking away voters' rights able to do it without, I mean, it used to be they would do this and it was a conspiracy. Everyone would say it happened. As in Gore v. Bush back then. When
it was Bush v. Gore. Bush brought that lawsuit. Yeah.
Right. And there were 70,000 taken off the rolls then, and now they're just doing it in plain sight, which to me is this shift in, I think, apathy or some other sociological, you know,
these kind of things are being promoted by the American Legislative Exchange Council, which has as its members and is funded by giant corporations all across the United States and around the world, apparently. And many of these, you know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and others, you know, they're putting the money into this. And these corporations then have interlocking boards of directors with the big media companies. So, Joe, thanks very much for the call. But this is my take on what's going on, is that basically what you have is an oligarchy. You've got this interlocking system of power and control, and a chunk of it is in the media. If you really want to see a fascinating insight into this, a glimpse into this, go to theyrule.net. Theyrule, as in they rule our country. Theyrule.net. Not org or com, .net. Check it out. You will be astounded. Jerry, and it's all done with publicly available information. Jerry in Naples, Florida. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
How you doing?
Good.
I'd like to bring out a point about this Ryan plan. And people that are in my age group in their late 40s to early 50s better open up their eyes, because if Ryan plan comes out tomorrow and you're under 55, you're going to be, excuse my language, you're going to be screwed, because
yep.
You're going to get a voucher. You're going to get this voucher. And you think with this voucher you're going to get right now, I'll give you an example. My neighbor, 75 years old, you know, triple bypass, a new kidney, all this on Medicare, you know, you're not going to get that same kind of health care. We're at that point. And
no.
People, you know, for their prejudices of, you know, not voting for Obama, you know, like him or not, when I vote for president, I don't vote for president. I vote for party. And I vote for, you know, what's right for me. But, you know, if they mess around with Medicare and Social Security, these people are going to hurt. You're only going to hurt themselves.
Well, not only that, here's why a 20-year-old should care about it, Jerry. If you're 20 years old and right now in the United States are 25 years old, you've got an insurance policy against disaster in your life that is worth about $2 million, and it's called Social Security. If you're 20 years old and you fall off anything and you break your neck and you end up a quadriplegic and you can't work and you're stuck at home, Social Security will pay. Social Security will pay for your medical expenses. Social Security will pay for your living expenses.
Right.
I mean, Social Security, you know, the disability insurance is a third of what Social Security pays out is to people who are severely disabled. And the vast majority of them, probably well over 90% of them, are not over 65. They're young people. And so young people have this huge insurance policy in Social Security, and Pete Peterson and the think tank that he's and all the various organizations that he's spent over $400 million funding, because he's a Wall Street fat cat and he would love to get that $2.7 trillion in the Social Security Trust Fund, and all these people who are going to pay homage to him, like did here in the last week, a week and a half ago here in Washington D.C., where Bernie Sanders and us hadn't protested. And those folks, they don't get it. I don't think the average American, in their 20s or 30s realizes that Social Security right now stands as an insurance policy, as a disability insurance policy for them. In fact, the disability insurance companies would probably love it if Social Security got privatized by Wall Street, because then, you know, the disability part would go away and you'd have to pay them $100 a month for disability insurance.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, I'm originally from New York, and I live in Florida now. And it's funny, the mentality of some people, you know, I don't know if they're, you know, I'm not going to say they're uneducated, but, you know, you tell somebody, oh, you know, they're going to take away your guns. Nobody's taking away nobody's guns. They forget about everything. They don't care about things like this. I never seen people that, like, you know, listen, you need this. You need this for your family. Like you said, if you're in your 20s, you're a young guy, you get married, something happens to you, you're going to need the Social Security.
Yep.
Guys like me in my 50s, when you hit 52, 53, you know, your body starts hurting already, you know? You know, there's no way, you know, when you get to your 70s, you know, you're going to need this, you know?
Yep.
You get you a voucher. Who's going to take you and say, yeah, at 70 years old, here's my voucher. I need my triple bypass. Yeah, see you later, pal.
Yeah. Well, I don't understand is how, you know, the Republicans, almost unanimously, I think there were either 7 or 12 dissenting votes among the Republicans in the House of Representatives, voted to pass Paul Ryan's budget that would have voucherized Medicare. And I don't understand how any of those people are going to get reelected. And you know, I think that it goes back to Thomas Jefferson said a democracy can only, I'm paraphrasing badly here, but he said that a democracy can only function if it has a well-educated and well-informed populace. And people who watch Fox News actually know less than people who watch no news whatsoever. And so we have a big problem in this country, not just with people not knowing things and not learning things in school, not learning things from the news, but with people actually being misinformed. Coming up tomorrow, how to avoid the austerity trap and still deal with the budget deficit. Robert Reich is going to drop by, plus my favorite segment of the week, Geeky Science. Could a fertility gene lead to a new male contraceptive? And the best of the rest of the news and your calls. Don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.